And there is an insignificant aspect of the Shabbat. When I say insignificant, only because for those who are not tuned into religion, they're not even aware of this particular aspect that takes place in the Shabbat before Purim. And for those who even still clinging on to a little religion, this aspect is very insignificant. Meaning, yes, it's something we have to do. I'm referring to the additional reading. I'm referring to the additional reading on the Shabbat before Purim, which obviously is connected with Purim. And that is the parasha known as Parashat Zachor. Parashat Zachor. The section that deals with remembering. And this seems to be very significant because of all of the readings, of all of the readings that are conducted on all holidays and all of the Shabbatot, there is no reading that is required to be attended by women. Strange. Women do not have to listen, are not required. And when we say required, we're not talking about religiosity. And I know I repeat that very often when I say there is no Jewish religion. And but nevertheless, I'm using the word required, chayav, obligation, because most of you are maybe familiar with that term. From a Kabbalistic point of view, we would not use the word chayav to say obligation, but it comes from the word chiyuv, or positiveness. In other words, there is no obligation, period. Then what is it? It is another method, another channel, by which we can connect, draw, and tap energies. Because no such thing as religion. God doesn't require us to perform for the service of Him, because He certainly doesn't need anything that we could, by virtue of prayer or service, performing of the mitzvot, in any way that we can benefit Him. So therefore, we treat these mitzvot as something that can produce positive energy, right column energy. So returning to this Parashat Zachor, in Halakha, it is stated that women, in addition to men, are required to hear this very small but very powerful reading once a year. It is the only time that women are required to attend a minyan. Meaning, why required? If I'm using the word required, then I'm again guilty of what I said we weren't, and that was religion. And that was required, meaning women should attend. But again, from a Kabbalistic point of view, it means that this is so urgent and important that women, to enhance and increase their energy, their positive energy, of which they are at the very beginning, much further advanced than men. For those of you who have taken the beginner's course of the center are familiar with what constitutes, or when we say constitute, what is the internal energy of women and what is the internal energy of men? In other words, why do women appear in a physical bodily form as they do, and why do men appear? In other words, we know that things do not originate from a physical point of view, but for most of us, thinking goes into what ultimately develops onto a physical realm. You think before you build a building. It is not that you first proceed to build the building and then figure out how the building should look. That's quite obvious. Therefore, from a Kabbalistic point of view, when we are discussing man and woman, we are discussing what internal energy, thought, intelligence produced the woman to look the way she does and all of the other characteristics that surround women and what surrounds men. So, again, Parashat Zachor is something that despite women who have this abundance of positive energy, and that's why we know women are kind of more sharing, and that's why, in fact, women are built and instructed so as they can be the channel by which life has continuity, not man. Because a child should be given that opportunity to be enveloped in what? Water. You know, every fetus, every embryo is involved and enveloped with water. You ask a gynecologist or a medical man why that, and then he laughs at you and he says, what kind of questions are those? Are you discussing why things are the way they are? In medicine, we only treat and deal with things as they are. But we know why. Because it is as urgent to the embryo as it is to the bulb to have a right column, or what we call a positive pole. And ask even the electrical scientist, electrical engineer, why is there a positive pole? The answer is, of course, I don't know. And we know it's, in fact, almost superfluous without going into the details, but no one understands why there should be a positive pole. But we understand that without an injection of positive energy, without a channel of positive energy, meaning plus, things do not become circuitry. So despite the internal energy intelligence of women, which is in far an excess of man's positivity, she is required to listen to this reading of the Torah. I'm speaking now from a Kabbalistic point of view, because from a halakha point of view, there aren't too many even Orthodox women that you might say do observe the halakha that are astringent in this particular matter of listening to the kriya, listening to the reading of this aspect called Parashat Zachor. Now, what is the significance of listening to this Parashat Zachor? And furthermore, why is it so bound up with and seems to have an inevitable link with Purim? The Parashat Zachor is mentioned in two sections of the Torah. One is in the Parashat Bishalach that we discussed last time, the secret of the 72 names, the secret of all awesome power that exists on a potential level. And for those who begin to learn this, the method by which we can connect with this awesome power, all of this instruction we discussed last time is included in Parashat Bishalach. Parashat Bishalach, we met the splitting of the Red Sea and also the many other aspects, many negative aspects. But immediately preceding the story of Zachor, which is mentioned in Parashat Bishalach, chapter 17, for those of you who would like to read it. In chapter 17, it says like this: after seeing all the miracles, and in fact, in this parsha, I should say in chapter 16, we have the parsha Taman, manna from heaven. We would all love manna from heaven, something for nothing. For most of us, we do not experience manna. It's a very tedious and sometimes burdensome kind of experience before we can get what we even think is maybe manna from heaven. But anyway, here the Jews witness the plagues and witness the splitting of the Red Sea and received manna from heaven. And after all of these beautiful things, comes chapter 17. And it says that they were traveling. And they were journeying from the wilderness of Sinai, and they camped in Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Wherefore the people strove, argued with Moses, and said, give us water, that we may drink. And Moses said unto them, why do you argue with me? Why, you know, wherefore do you try the Lord? I mean, are you still not sure? And you think the Jews would have thought for a minute, well, listen to what Moses is saying, what he's trying to tell us. So many miracles have happened before. You mean this miracle of producing water? I mean, manna from heaven, that's easy. Splitting the Red Sea, that's easy. But now how are they going to get water in the desert? That became very difficult. To the extent that the Jews said, and the Jews murmured against Moses and said, wherefore hast thou brought us out of Egypt to kill us? Send our children, our cattle with thirst. What an awful Moses, what an awful creator. Now we here sitting in the 20th century must be thinking about these Jews. I don't know, they're funny kind of Jews. I mean, we certainly, if any of us experienced only once in our lifetime, the splitting of the Red Sea, or a personal miracle that everyone would agree to the miracle, who would then come back to the Creator and say, well, what'd you do for me today? Or today it doesn't look so good, but maybe that's the Jewish trait, which personally I think is the hallmark of Jews, and that is, what did you do for me today? Which we'll understand the fact more clearly as we go on. But in any event, this is what it says. This is what the Jew was during the time of the Exodus. And it then goes on to say in verse 7 of chapter 17, and this is the code for understanding not only Purim, not only what creation was all about, but what Parshat Zachor is all about. Verse 7, and the name of the place where this argument between, and of course I didn't read that the miracle came and the water appeared. Now, it wasn't that difficult for the Creator to produce water for these thirsty people. And then it says, Moses did so at the sight of the elders, and the name of the place was called Massah and Meribah, because the arguments of the children of Israel, and because they tried the Lord, saying, is the Lord amongst us or not? Ayesh Hashem bikirbenu im ayin. Ayesh Hashem bikirbenu im ayin. Is the Lord amongst us or not? It doesn't say that, really. It says that they were arguing, where's water? And did the Creator bring us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? And then Moshe says, which was not mentioned at all, but it seems that Moshe understands something that from the surface of what has been stated in this chapter is not very clear, and in fact is coded. He says, because they weren't sure that the Lord was amongst them or not. And then immediately after, what happens? Vayavo Amalek v'yilachem im Yisrael b'fidim. And then along comes Amalek. At the very moment, following Hayesh Hashem b'kibenu imayin. There they were. Now I heard this from my teacher. And this word, Hayesh Ayin, yes or no, if you know a little Hebrew, yesh means yes, there is. Ayin means there is not. Doubt. This is the essence of what Moshe was saying here. The Jews had doubts. If you recall the eating of the forbidden fruit in Gan Eden, in paradise, when the snake convinced Eve to eat from the forbidden fruit. And in chapter 3, verse 13, it says, Vayom Hashem Elokim la'isha Ma zot asita? And Hashem told the woman, meaning Eve, what did you do? Vatomer ha'isha hanachash hishiani va'ochel. The snake, hishiani. Well, hishiani means in the frame of this verse, the snake convinced me that it was all right that I eat, hishiani, and therefore I ate. But if we take notice of the word hishiani, it's another code. And therefore, it doesn't mean, in fact, what 10 translators of this word imply. You know, first of all, if you have 10 meanings to a word, you know you're probably wrong. And here, hishiani spells out, there are 6 letters here, and there are 6 letters here. Hayesh, ayin. Both these two little words are the same 6 letters that appear in this word. Strange, but there's your code. Again, for those of you who have never participated in these lectures, you know that you can't read the Bible and understand the Bible as it is written, because it's completely coded. Completely coded. And when I say coded, meaning without the Kabbalah, there is no way of knowing the essence of what is being presented here. Now the woman, it says hishiani, which means, again, the secret of what I call now in my new book that'll be coming out shortly, the Dark Lord. That's the Sitra Achra. There is one basic problem that everyone in this universe is confronted at one time or another. The only time he is no longer confronted with that problem is when he has achieved total freedom, which comes to maybe 10, 20, or 50 people out of the 4.5 billion people in the world. What do I mean by total freedom? That there is no thinking or no questions of what is to happen tomorrow. There is no doubts, no uncertainty. The biggest problem that mankind faces is what? Doubt. Doubt. If everyone knew that tomorrow is going to be just as he wants it to be, but of course he doesn't know yet what tomorrow is, and therefore what happens? He has doubts. Who knows what tomorrow will bring? But assuming that there were no doubts, it was all clear, then he is a free man. What does it mean he is a free man? He has no needs, because the needs that he might even have today, he is totally convinced that tomorrow, which is already here, and we've discussed that, tomorrow is already here, and tomorrow is going to provide me with everything that I need. You might say that this is a man who has achieved freedom. Freedom. Freedom of what? One word, uncertainty, because all of the other needs that we think we have are really connected with one problem, uncertainty. I'm not sure if all of those things that I'm going to need throughout my lifetime, and I don't know what I might need, let's say, in 10 years around, or when I retire. I mean, there are always things that I could be thinking about now that creates an uncertainty for most people in the world. In fact, what letter created the world? What letter created the world? Of all the letters in the power of the alphabet, the bet. The bet was chosen. Why was the bet chosen? Why was the bet chosen? Because the bet came forward to the Creator, to the Lord, and said, my letter is the energy intelligence, because the first letter of any word is the keter, is the crown. That's why it appears first in the word. It's like the seed of a word. If you have a 5-letter word, the first letter is the keter of it, and that dictates what the fiber of this word is all about. And in fact, its energy intelligence flows right through and weaves through the fiber of this word. And the bet came and said, I represent bracha, blessing. I represent bracha, because the word bracha begins with a bet, and if there is bracha in the world, and if there is bracha in the world, everything is here. Everything is here. Now, if we stop for a moment to think about brachot, we know, if we just treat it on a superficial level, no one here or anywhere in the world, unless you learned a little Kabbalah, can give me a definition of bracha. Give me an instance of bracha. No one here can give me an instance of pure blessing. Why? Because if my friend Jack, who deals so heavily in the stock market day and night, he doesn't deal with it at all, but let me use that as an example. He's buying, thinking the market goes up. And if the market falls on its face, Jack has lost the bundle. Then there's no blessing. But that's not true, because there must be someone in that market who has sold short. And so for what happens to be a klala, chas v'shalom, for Jack, is a blessing for him. There is nothing in this universe that happens that you can say is a pure klala or a pure bracha. So what does bracha mean? If everything can be a blessing, and at the same time, that same action could be a curse for another person. So how can Bet have presented itself and said, Bet, I present bracha? So without going into that full chapter on what bracha really means, but in a few words, bracha means certainty. Bracha means certainty. No doubts. No doubts. That means that the person who, let's say, take this example, sees the market crumbling, says, it's an illusion. It's an illusion. What do you mean? He opens up the paper every day and he sees the market continuing to go down. He says, I know it's going up. So am I to get excited now in that it is going down? He's certain that it's going up. Anything that a person is certain that is going to be good, to where there's no doubts. And what happens when there's no doubts? There's continuity. Nothing has stopped in the middle to create aggravation. So what is blessing in essence? Certainty. No doubts. How do I know that we're getting closer to Mashiach? Because when all physics has to now be based upon one word, uncertainty. They have come with the new revelation of the 20th century that everything, and they said the word everything, but they are not Kabbalists. So I'm not in total agreement with them. I'm in partial agreement with them. They have come to the conclusion that everything in this universe is an illusion. But that hasn't filtered down to, you see, to we laymen. See, they keep that for themselves, because what would happen if all people began to be convinced that everything is uncertain? We couldn't exist for more than one day, because what I see today and what appears to be a certain movement that seems to be going in a certain direction, the physicist is going to convince us, don't consider it as something to be sure about. Everything is uncertainty. Nothing is sure. This is a conclusion. Now, since 1927, that has not been abandoned, that the entire universe is one of uncertainty. And it happens. Sometimes someone has health, and another time he loses his health. And every time the fear of losing one's health is always there. If you're young, you always fear what would happen when you get older. Older people are usually the occupants in hospitals. You get older, you have amassed a certain amount of money, but there comes a time when you can't work, where you'll have to depend on what? On the money you have accumulated. Will it last? What happens if Chas v'Shalom, he lives until 120 years? He won't have enough money. Problems. You imagine all the problems that everyone goes through, not only when he gets older, but that uncertainty is with us all the time. And who's to say when we're dealing with a certain part of our life where we're not even sure about it, that we can't even make guarantees for tomorrow or the next day. So what is true blessing? True blessing, where an awareness of certainty has stepped in. That is blessing. That is blessing. Where there is absolutely an assurance that tomorrow will come with no defects, because uncertainty is with lacks. What's uncertainty? I'm not sure it'll last. The money may not last. So what is it saying? It may not be enough. Lack. There's a certain defect. There's not enough. Certainty takes care of that. Certainty says, I know. I know. Now the bet came forward and said two things. It says, I'm bracha, but I also am the kind of letter that is going to secure blessing. How does it secure blessing? It says, look at the way I'm structured. We know that letters, the Hebrew letter specifically, are structured so as not to leave any room for doubt what they represented. What is the unique structure of Bet? It has three vavin, three letter vavs. Now, you know that three letter vavs, 3 times 6 is 18, and I don't want to go into the full ramification of what vav means, but vav means a composite of central column, a composite of 6. And if you have 6 times 3, that's where the word chai comes, means life. In other words, there's certainty. The bet, again, I don't want to go into the bet because I want to stick to the ideas we're presenting here insofar as Purim is concerned. The bet is structured to consist of 3 vav. And that's chai. That's life. Life is when there is certainty. When there is no certainty, we are not living because we're always living in fear. We are not living. We are living for the fear of tomorrow. So there is always in bet, if you know how to connect with bet, there will always be blessing. That's what he meant. Because the bet said there are 2 levels in this universe. There's a level of Houdini, right? There is a level of a Doug Henning that today can take an airplane in front of 1,000 people and make it disappear. And make it disappear. Of course there's a trick to it. Of course there's a trick. But everyone is convinced as they see it. And when you don't, and when you know how he does it, does that turn away the idea that he made the entire plane disappear before our very eyes? It still disappears. Now we know how to do it. So we'll do it, and we'll fool other people. The aspect of illusion is nothing strange and foreign to us. We're all familiar with these magical tricks. But in essence, we are convinced that we have seen with our own eyes about things that happen while we know it can't be true, but they appear to us as having taken place. The plane disappeared. For most people, the reason that there is uncertainty is because life on a physical realm presents itself as an illusion. As an illusion. The illusion of a market going up. Does it mean for Jack, he'll say, well, it's going up, then it must be good. So it's bad for someone who has sold and is going down. Can it be a fact? No, because it can represent this way or that way. And it can go the other way. That is illusion. That is part of our life that we believe as we deal with it from moment to moment. You see, this is reality. But we have to accept already what the Kabbalist says and what the scientist says. We live in an illusion. We live in an absolute illusion, and therefore we cannot be free. The only time we can become free is when we have stepped out of the realm of illusion into the realm of reality. But for anyone to decide today that what we see in front of our eyes is reality is living now in the dark ages. It is the one who says, I don't want to be confronted with illusion. I don't want to be governed by illusion. I want to live in the world of reality, because in the world of reality, there is no lack. That is blessing. Here, when it says, Hayesh Hashem b'kibenu imayin, when they did not execute restriction, the Jew, which he was taught already in this parsha, the secret of the 72 letters, he was taught how to tap the energy of the cosmos that he will eternally have whatever he needs. Not whatever he wants, but whatever he needs. Because whatever you want, they give you that too. Whatever you want, they give you too. But what you wanted may not have been good because you didn't see tomorrow, right? If you wanted, you had to take a trip and the plane crashed. Would that have been good? No. You want to be sure that what you need is always provided for, not what you want. So here the Jew complained and again complained. What does it mean in essence? He did not exercise restriction. And because he did not exercise restriction, he fell back from the realm of reality where he had achieved with the splitting of the Red Sea. What do you mean splitting of the Red Sea? Maybe it was magic. Makes no difference. Let's say it was magic. Did he cross the sea? For him, did it happen? If it happened, that's what happened, says the scientist. It's true. Okay. Therefore, this aspect of Hayesh Hashem b'kibenu imayin was the fact of uncertainty. Now, what happened all of a sudden with uncertainty? Because they did not exercise restriction. In other words, give me, give me, give me, typical of the Jew. And he fell back from the realm of reality back to the illusionary realm, where now he's got to think all day, all of his life. He's got to think, will I have for tomorrow? Will it work out for me for tomorrow? That's a slave to tomorrow. He does not live today, although we think he lives for today. Even the one who says, live for today, because who knows if there'll be a tomorrow. But nobody who lives for today doesn't think of tomorrow. It's a saying, live for today. But tomorrow is always in doubt. What is it going to bring? I'm going to fly out a plane. Chas v'shalom, the plane can crash. So many things can happen tomorrow because we don't know about tomorrow. That's where they fell back to the illusionary realm, because on another level, everything is known. Everything is known because tomorrow is known today. How do we know it's known today? How do we know it's known today? Because the law of cause and effect says that what precedes something that comes afterwards must be included in the before. That's the rule of physics, cause and effect. The seed contains the whole tree. Whatever is going to come later is already included in the seed. The law of cause and effect. That means tomorrow's here now. So how come not all of us see tomorrow? Why don't we have a recollection of tomorrow like we have a recollection of yesterday? The answer is, because if we look at tomorrow as something different than today, then we are back into the world of illusion. And if we're back into the world of illusion, let's say we see tomorrow. Let's say we see tomorrow. And it goes up. Everything becomes perfect. Just what we want. Not what we need, but what we want. That very same thing that we're getting because we see tomorrow may not satisfy the needs. Because not everything that we do and is successful has brought what we need. So again, we are not discussing what we want. We are discussing what we need. What we need. What we need doesn't mean that I can see tomorrow and I have already fulfilled the needs of today. Therefore, because they fell back into the realm of Hayesh and Ayin, that's what happened with Eve, with the snake. She said, he put doubts into my mind. Hishiani, he put doubts. In other words, what did he say to me? Eat from the Etz HaChaim. What was the Etz HaChaim? Etz Achayim meant one thing. Certainty. Life. Certainty. What did the Nachash do? Pushed him right back into the realm, convinced him that the realm of illusion is a better realm. Is a better realm. How many times we love to dream and imagine things. Don't we feel better most of the times? But there we're forgetting that what we think in the terms of illusion is probably reality. But I won't go into that. He brought doubt into Eve. And the minute he brought doubt into Eve, what happened? With the Jew, she was driven out. With the Jew came Amalek. And what does it tell us about the story of Amalek? That he came, and now Moshe got together. And you, if you remember the story, and it says that, and it came to pass in verse 11 of chapter 17, and it came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon. Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, one on one side, being Aaron, which was right column, Hur, which was left column, and there was a three-column factor here. The Bet. Moshe. This is, again, is a code. Here's a story that you can read that tells us about Moshe and Hur and Aaron. They performed this miracle of raising their hands. And a miracle was created. That is not what happened. What happened was they created with the realm of reality. How? By the three columns. The three columns. The Bet. The Bet is the connection to reality. And when that happened, they were victorious. And then it says in verse 13, and Joshua felt weak. And when he felt weak, what happened? Because Moshe felt weak. The three-column system. So we go back and forth from illusion to reality. Why? If our restriction falters, if the three-column system falters, you become weak. You go back to the realm of illusion. You go back to the realm of illusion. Uncertainty. It looks like Amalek is winning. It looks like maybe Amalek is not winning. But the moment his hands were raised, meaning he established a three-column system, there was no question. There was no question. Amalek was lost. In fact, it doesn't even say. It just says, V'gavar Amalek, when he was weak. And when Moshe was strong, Amalek had no power. What is Amalek? Again, Amalek is not something to be considered as the enemy of the people or the Jewish people. No less than Germany was not the enemy of the Jewish people. According to the Zohar, the enemy of the Jewish people is Amalek, which is ourselves. That's a Zohar interpretation. Amalek is not that enemy. He is the effect. He is the effect of our activity. And this shows us here that when Moshe was strong with the three-column system, Amalek had no power. Amalek meaning our own power. When he was strong, there was no doubts. No one had to turn on their TV and observe who was winning or what was happening. It was certain. If you connect it to the realm of reality with the three-column system, there was no question. And then it says, and Moses says, write this down for a memorial, Zot Zikaron Basefer, V'sim Basnei Yeshua, and put it into the ears of Joshua. Ki machom emche ezechra Amalek mitachat ha-shamayim. All right? Now this aspect of remembering, this is what we began off from the beginning by saying, Parshat Zachor, that women need this Parsha, this Shabbat, to listen to this Parsha. The Parsha that is going to be read is found in the Parsha of Ki Tetzeh, at the end, Ki Tetzeh. And what does it say there? In chapter 25, And you probably heard this, heard me repeat this many a times, but I guess if the Bible has to repeat this many times, I guess I have the liberty to also, and the free will to this, to repeat as many times I have to the same concept. Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek baderech betzetchem mimitzrayim. Remember what Amalek did unto you when you went out of Egypt. You were weak. You were weak, and you had no fear of God. And therefore it shall be when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies, thou shalt blot out, timche et zecher Amalek, blot out the remembrance of Amalek, mitachat ha-shamayim, and then he winds up with, lo tishkach, do not forget. Now, how many times does he have to tell the Jew, remember, verse 17, verse 19, again, remember. And then, in fact, we have to repeat that, that zecher twice. And then at the end, he says, lo tishkach. Well, of course, if you remember, you do not forget. But I say it's rather very simple. That what is happening here in this sentence is describing the Jew, the short memory Jew. Remember the short memory Jew in Egypt? Miracles. What are you doing for me today, Lord? Miracles again. But there's one more thing that I'm missing. Not that they needed, they wanted water. Couldn't God make it so, or couldn't they think for a minute that God is so all-powerful that you know what he can do? He'll make you feel that as if you're not hungry. An illusion, you're not hungry or not thirsty. Has that ever happened to us? Of course. You read a book, you feel full. Many illusions, but they are realities. You really don't feel like you want to eat. So couldn't God have done that? Make an illusion. You're not thirsty. Not with the Jew. He forgets all that, you see. And therefore, he constantly has to be reminded that because the desire to receive for the Jew is so strong, it is so strong, and that desire to receive for oneself alone, which is the hallmark of the Jew particularly, because of its strength, of that kind of energy, it creates short memories. It limits. It creates uncertainty. What happens with the Jew he needs for tomorrow? He's not satisfied because he wasn't sure what tomorrow will bring. He constantly lives in the realm of illusion, more so than any other nation in the world. More so. And therefore, he's always on the go. He's the Schwitzer. He's always the one moving or running. Why? Because he has that internal energy intelligence that creates short memories. And short memories create uncertainty. And short memories is a vicious cycle. Because the minute you have what you need, you're back tomorrow with another want. And it's never ending. And therefore, a Jew can find it very difficult to become free. That's the entire lesson of B'Shalach and of the whole Torah, to teach the Jew, because he has this powerful channel to energy, and that's what the greatest desire to receive in effect means, because the stronger the negativity, the stronger the possibility of drawing energy. The difference between a 5-watt bulb and a 200,000-watt bulb is the potential capacity of drawing that current. That was Parshat Zachar. Therefore, even if one is a woman, and a Jewish woman at that, despite the positivity that exists, but, shall I say fortunately or unfortunately, she's still Jewish. And because she is still Jewish, that aspect of short memory that is described here so many times is that to overcome uncertainty, even women, with all of their positivity. Well, what does positivity mean? Tomorrow's going to be good, right? Tomorrow's going to be good. You know, the Israeli, what does he say? Yeah, tov. I always ask him, al smach ma, you know, on what basis is it going to be good? The basis of 2,000 years of Holocaust and trauma and turmoil. And he says it's going to be good tomorrow. Why? He lives in an illusion. He lives in an absolute delusion that he can even dream of saying that tomorrow is going to be better. Why would tomorrow be better? What was so good for the last 2,000 years that will absolutely bring tomorrow the cause and effect, he says, right? Cause today is horrible, tomorrow will be better. But the cause is the beginning of the effect. Today is the beginning for tomorrow. So why will it be good tomorrow? Shows you the mentality of a Jew. Incredible. Incredible that he can even use that kind of expression. Therefore, all people are required to listen to this. Now, what is the purpose of listening? So again, we know that the listening of the Torah on Shabbat is not an obligation. If life is good for you, you have my heter, you have my permission never to go to the synagogue. Because going to the synagogue has nothing to do with obligation. You think you need energy? You think you want freedom? Here's another channel, another coded message by which on the Shabbat is established this aspect of freedom. Now, what does this have to do with Purim? What does it have to do with Purim? Because you recall that all of us need this aspect, Parshat Zachar, before the coming of Purim. In other words, whether Purim will be on Sunday or Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday or Thursday, but the week preceding, the Shabbat preceding Purim, this is what is essential. In other words, it's like a prerequisite to capturing what Purim is all about. Now again, as you know, for most Jews throughout the world who are still into this little Purim scene, all it means is what? To be merry, and there's nothing wrong with being merry. But is that the entire significance? Is that the entire significance of Purim? The answer is no. The answer is no. It is called Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther. The words themselves mean the paradox. Megillah comes from the word legale, to reveal. Esther comes from the word concealed. Two opposites. But in essence, that Megillat Esther, which we will, Saturday night when we read the Megillah, there will be a more thorough and to the point explanation of what that's all about, the reading of the Megillah. That concealment became revealed. What does that mean? It means that there was no uncertainty. There was no uncertainty. A cosmic event took place where uncertainty could disappear for those Jews at that time. We know that Yom Kippur is the holiest day of the year, meaning on a cosmic level, it provides the most intense kind of energy for us to last throughout the year. And Yom Kippur is also referred to as Yom Kippurim. In other words, this day is as Purim. It's not like Purim, Yom Kippur, but almost like Purim. That is the literal translation of Yom Kippurim. As Purim. As Purim. Yom Kippurim. All right? Why is it called as Purim? In other words, almost to indicate to us that Yom Kippur is not as high. Is not as high as Purim itself. And the answer is, again, very simple. The distinction. Purim is absolutely more significant than Yom Kippur. As it says, Yom Kippurim is like Purim. Why? Because while we can connect on Yom Kippur, the time when positivity came out was on Sukkot. When was the completion of all of this energy? On Hashanah Rabbah. I won't go into the details of it. But in all of Sukkot, what was established? Chasadim. That's why it's called Nisuch HaMayim, the spilling of waters, because water has this positive internal energy. Yom Kippur did not provide that kind of energy as Purim does. Purim was an instant tearing away of the curtain. Instant. Yom Kippur is not. You still need Sukkot, because like in the bulb, what happens if you have the negative pole drawing in the energy and you don't have another pole called positivity? Don't have a circuit. You need both. When do we acquire in Tishrei that Chos Chasadim, which is called the positive right column pole like the bulb? On Sukkot, we have to wait. We have to wait. On Purim, you get it all at once. The revelation comes all at once. There is no delay in the revelation. That's why it's called Megillat Esther, that the Seter, the concealment, was immediately revealed. How does that happen? How does that happen? And I might add, that's why Purim has lost all of its significance, because we have lost maybe what was the importance of what happened on Purim. Do we celebrate Purim because they were victorious? Of course not. Do we celebrate Purim because it's tradition? They did it and therefore we do it. We know from a Kabbalistic point of view, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Then why are we celebrating Purim? Because we know that Purim happened on that day, and not another day. Why? Why? Because on that day, I can have immediate certainty. I can have immediate bracha, even more so than on Yom Kippur, which I have to wait until Sukkot. On this day, a cosmic event is taking place. Why is it taking place? There is a Gemara, in fact, the first Mishnah in Tractate of Megillah says that there are certain places where they began the reading of the Megillah, Yud Aleph Ba'adah, the 11th day of Adah, until the 15th day. The 15th day is cities like Shushan, which had a wall around. We'll discuss that Motzei Shabbat in greater detail. But here I'm just mentioning the Mishnah that says that the Megillah was read from beginning of Yud Aleph of Adah, the 11th day of Adah, and continued 12, 13, 14, 15. And that was the last day where it was read anywhere in the world. And that was read in all of those cities that had a wall around it, like Yerushalayim. Tzfat is a safek, but Tveria had a wall around it, so it's read also on the 15th day. But what is strange in that Gemara, and no one picked it up, other than my teacher picked it up, it says in the Gemara, Lo pachot velo yoter. The Gemara says, not less and not more. Not less than the 11th day in Adah, and not more than the 11th day of Adah. Now, if you know grammar, the proper language should have been not before and not after. If you're supposed to read the Megillah, not before the 11th day of Adar and not after the 15th day of Adar, so it should say, not before, lo kodem, v'lo achreze. That is not the expression of the Mishnah. It says, lo pachot, not less and not more. Not less and not more doesn't seem to fit the wording of the expression. We have learned, for those of you anyway who have learned, why there are 30 days in a lunar month. 30 days. If you speak to a scientist, he says it takes 30 days for the moon to make its rotation around the earth. What does the Kabbalist ask? Don't tell me what it does. I don't want to know about, because maybe it's an illusion. Maybe it doesn't rotate. And there is no one today that can tell you that the moon takes 30 days, 1 day, or 80 days. Why? Because in the physical reality realm, the scientist says, what is the dominant factor there? One word. What is it? Uncertainty. Uncertainty. That means, and the Talmidei, the sages of the Talmud knew that too. That the world of physicality is the world of illusion. The world of physicality is the world of illusion. So therefore we ask, if there is such a concept mentioned in the Talmud, if there is such a concept mentioned in Talmud of 30 days to the month, we know that there is a force that makes that moon rotate around the earth for 30 days. Now, what we want to determine is, what is that force that makes 30 days? Why is there 30 days? Why does it go up? Why does it go down? You can read books on astronomy from today until tomorrow. And I offer anyone a Nobel Prize if you will show me in one area or one book that mentions why and give you a proper answer. They do not even deal with the question of why. But the Zohar does, because he doesn't want to deal with illusions. He wants to deal with the hidden energies, because energy is never seen. Electric current is not seen. Can't see things of the physical realm. You can see a table. The 90% or 99% of the table, which is atoms, cannot be observed by the naked eye. Things, unless you, all day you want to walk around with a microscope, you may begin to get a hint of the, you know, the world of reality. But with the naked eye, you see nothing, because 99% of existence can only be seen through a microscope. So we're therefore asking, why 30 days? Why 30 days? Why does the moon go up, or it appears to be ascending? And at the 15th day, what happens? It starts descending. Why? Why? The answer given by the Zohar is very simple. When you get the figure 30 and you've learned a little Kabbalah, you've already put that together. And it means what? Three. Means three. It means right column, left column, and central column. The atom. The atom has been placed in this universe for only one reason. Because there is no greater physical, and I don't want to speak about the hydrogen, but the atom is a force, a powerful force in this universe, and it is not by coincidence that the atom must consist, and does consist, of how many forces? Three basic forces: proton, neutron, and electron. There are three forces that operate every month. The first one is what? Right column. Positivity. What is positivity? Chesed. It extends out. Things grow. Things grow. For the first 10 months, first 10 days. The last 10 days, what is the last 10 days? We see this, the moon going down. From 10 to 20, the middle 10 days, says the Zohar, is called the Kavamtsei, the central column months. Central column months. Now we know, we have, and we're learning, that the way Bet was bracha was because it consisted of three. You can't have just give me, give me, give me. You can't have only negativity. You must have sharing, and you must have restriction. So the first 10 days is when there is a completion of chesed, because of 10 Sfirot, which I don't want to go into, but you have 10 days. Now in the central column has 10 days too, but there are two aspects there. There is five, the first five, meaning from 11 to 15, and the Mishnah will be beautiful, because that code in the Mishnah, if you learn Talmud, and you don't learn Rabbi Shimon's explanation on Talmud, you don't get to the essence. The Mishnah is beautiful. The Mishnah is beautiful. It is telling you precisely what the cosmos are all about and what Purim is all about, just by saying lo pachot velo yoter, not less and not more. Because before 10 days are over, before 10 days are over, do you have the completion of the positive energy into the cosmos? No. It requires full 10 days. That's the, I hope we'll have time for the Aseret HaDibrot, which means 10. Nothing operates without the number 10, even your telephone system. The dialing requires 10. Ask the fellow who devised it, why 10? Couldn't they make 11 numbers or 9 numbers? No, the Sefer Yetzirah says 10, not 9, not 11, 10. So those who come to the yeshiva in the morning know why that's all, what that's all about and why it's necessary. But 10, before you have 10, you do not have a complete cycle. We'll take an interruption here. All right, hafsaka. Now we're